Thank you for tuning in to the best parenting show on the internet, Post Daily Dose.
So thanks for coming back and joining me for Fearless Parenting. Effective discipline with fearless parenting. How dialing down fear in degrees can create less stress and more peace. Effective discipline. The definition of discipline is to teach, not to punish. Let's say that again. The definition of discipline is to teach, not to punish. Now I want you to think about this. If you've got a student or a child, doesn't matter which, because you got to teach them regardless. If stress causes confused and distorted thinking and suppresses the short-term memory, and the definition of discipline is to teach, not to punish. If you want to be an effective disciple, you have to be an effective teacher. Do you want the child stressed out to try to learn, or do you want them to be in a state of calm? We want them to be in a state of calm. Because when they're stressed out, they can't learn. And if we truly want to be effective disciples, if we truly want to be effective teachers, then we have to first get our children into a place where their brains can actually learn. Which means we first have to get ourselves in a place, and our brains in a place to where we can effectively teach. An effective teacher doesn't try to yell over the top of everyone else. An effective teacher doesn't try to teach someone who's obviously not in a space to be able to learn. The best teacher you had in school growing up. How many of you can remember that one teacher? Your favorite teacher? Raise your hand. What was more significant about that teacher than any of the other teachers? I'll tell you what it is. They created a relationship with you. That teacher formed a relationship. Whether it was through letting you know that they cared, whether it was just from them being a really relaxed, laid-back individual, whether it was them connecting to you on an educational, academic level that you really dug, the denominator was the relationship. And the thing that keeps us out of relationship is stress and fear. Stress and fear keep us out of relationship. Stress and fear keep us focused on behavior. The only time you become obsessed on behavior is when you're in a place of stress. Fear says fix it. Love says create the relationship and maintain the environment to allow it to fix itself. The only time you seek to be in control is when you're in a state of stress and fear. The problem is that we don't know it. That's the problem. The problem is that we don't know that we're stressed. We don't know that we're scared. Because it's so unconscious. It's such an unconscious experience. So you can have anxiety that shows up. And you're not dialed into the fact that you are actually in a state of stress. You can get mad and you're not dialed into the fact that you're in a state of stress. You know, you feel your blood pressure go up, but you don't realize that that's connected to stress. And that stress is sending out a vibration. It's all emotional, and emotion is all vibration. And it's sending out a vibration. And my thesis is that you don't have to be, nor can you be, without stress or without fear. You can't be without stress or without fear, not having grown up in the society that we have and not living in the society that we still have today. There's just so much stress and there's so much trauma and there's so much fear that's all around us. It's around us all the time. So you can't be without it. But my thesis is that if you can dial it down by degrees. See, you are degrees away from a breakthrough in your home with your child. You are just degrees, degrees away. When you can dial down the fear just a little bit underneath where it's previously been, that's all you have to do. You don't have to be the walking Christ, the living Buddha. You don't have to be Gandhi in your home. You just have to be able to dial it down a little bit. And when you can dial it down a little bit, you create a space. And that space you create is a space of love. And that's where the magic happens. So when I start talking about fearless parenting, I'm talking about what is it that we need to do? What can we do to dial down the fear just in degrees? I don't need you to turn it all the way off. I just need you to dial it down in degrees. So I come back to this Bruce Perry quote again. Bruce Perry is my other guru. You guys don't know his work, you should look into it. He's a psychiatrist. He's been studying children and trauma for a long time. One of the best lessons you can learn in life is to master how to remain calm. I've been doing this work for 20 years. I have owned and operated group homes, treatment homes, schools, outpatient intensive in-home agencies. I've consulted in all of them. I've worked in all of them. I've lived in homes with kids. And I've traveled around the world working with families in their homes. And I'm going to tell you, this quote is everything. It is everything. And it seems so simple, yet we all have such a hard time with it. Because when I can master my ability to remain calm, and I'm going to tell you what the trick is. It's really not that difficult when we understand what we have to do. The trick is by not seeing threats. That's the trick. When your amygdala doesn't see a threat, when your amygdala, your fear receptor in your brain, looks at a negative behavior and doesn't see it as bad, means it doesn't cast a judgment, it doesn't see it as something that's scary, it doesn't see it as something that's going to put you in survival, you won't get as activated. So you'll be able to remain more calm where other people wouldn't be able to remain calm. Because you can see the child yelling and screaming and kicking and threatening and posturing. But if you don't see that as a threat, it keeps your amygdala dialed down. And when your amygdala dials down that vibration, that negative fear-based vibration stays dialed in. And when you keep that dialed down, then what you're not doing is you're not adding more fuel to the flame. See, when the child gets triggered and overwhelmed, when they go outside of their window of tolerance and they move into a state of dysregulation, they're in their trauma. They're waiting for something bad to happen. They're waiting for it. They're predicting it. They see it. They know what's going to happen because it's tapped into everything they've already experienced. So everything they've already experienced is what's threatening to happen again. It's showing it's ready, the radar, it's a fine-tuned instrument. They're ready to fight at the drop of a dime. They're ready to go. They're ready to take off running. They're ready to tear something. They're just ready. That's because all their trauma's at it. And all their trauma has said there's just nothing but bad that's going to happen right now. That's all they're looking for. So when you raise your eyebrow, oh, why are you looking at me that way? When you say, honey, you don't scream at me. When you say it's going to be, no, don't touch me. Because their amygdala's dialed up. And their amygdala sees threats. That's all they can see in that moment. And they're just waiting for you. So the more you dial up right with them, the more you just reinforce what they've already gone through, what they've already experienced. The more you stay dialed down, the more you don't reinforce them. The more you reinforce the opposite, I call it planting a love weed seed. You plant a love weed seed. Every time you don't react, you respond. When your child has a negative behavior, and instead of reacting, you respond, you plant a love weed seed. And the reason I call it a love weed is because we know that weeds grow in every environment, in the worst environments. So when you plant that love weed seed in the midst of all that trauma, When you're not reacting, that's what you're doing. You're planting a love wound seed. Bruce Perry says, our brains always return to the way the event was handled the last time. The brain always returns to the way the event was handled the last time. And if the brain's always returning to the way the event was handled the last time, whatever showed up the last time I was in distress is about to show up again. And however you handled it is what I'm going to go back to. So pretty soon, if you keep staying positive with me, if you keep staying regulated, and when you lose your stuff, if you come back and you apologize to me and you vow to do better, then you're planting those little love weed seeds in my brain, and search slowly but surely, I stop dropping so far back into that trauma. But here's the thing, and I closed on this early this morning. Negative behavior is the gift. It's the gift because it is the door into the trauma. The negative behavior is the door to the trauma. So I had a mom and dad come up and they said, we have an 11 or 12, 13 year old who gets stressed and wants to run away. He wants to run away. What do we do? It freaks me out. I try to keep him calm. I try to keep him in the home. Well, remember, that negative behavior, which has nothing to do with you, is coming from that kid's early history. It's coming from the early history. So I said, well, how old was he when you adopted him? Well, he was two. Well, what was that for two, before, up till two? Well, he was raised by a 15-year-old. So they probably spent a lot of time just walking the streets. He was probably one of those kids in the diaper when he was 12, walking down the street. So in his brain, when he gets stressed and that pathway opens, him taking off is just as natural as anything. It's our perception of his behavior that's the problem. Because we think something bad's gonna happen. So then what we start doing is we start trying to control the behavior. And when you start trying to control the behavior, you're operating out of fear. You're operating out of stress. It's very simple. When you start controlling, when you need to control, you're operating out of stress and fear. Because the opposite side of that is influence. Don't seek to control, seek to influence. And you only influence through relationship. So I said, next time he starts getting stressed out, say to him, hey, why don't you go for a walk? What? Yeah, just say, why don't you go for a walk? Mom says, but then he won't go. Fantastic, that's what we wanted anyway. That's how confused and distorted thinking happens. That quick. Now think about that. If my kid gets stressed and his reaction is to run, and I tell him, previously I didn't tell him to take a walk, but I tell him to take a walk and he doesn't go, and I see that as a bad thing, when in fact I'm stressed out because he runs away. You see how that happens? It happens so quick. And let me tell you why it happens. Because we have our own stuff. See, our own stuff is what's getting stirred up. When our own stuff gets stirred up, we can't think clearly. We get just confused. We get overwhelmed. And that's why Bruce Lee says the best thing you can do is master how to stay calm. You're not just mastering how to stay calm. You're mastering how to keep your amygdala from overwhelming you. You're mastering how to keep your cortisol down. You're mastering how to turn your oxytocin response on. How to create a loving vibration. You're not just mastering how to be calm. See, we have all these words we use, and they hold such surface meaning. Like soothing a child, like a baby who's crying, you're soothing the child, you rock them, and you make sure they've been fed, and their diapers, you Google, and you Google. You're not just soothing the child. You are massaging their brain. You are turning on their oxytocin response and flooding them with the love hormone, and that love hormone is rewiring their brain to make them feel safe. You're doing so much more than just soothing the child. But we use these words, we get so caught up in these words, and we have such surface meaning of these words. Mastering calm is mastering your brain, it's mastering your vibration, it's mastering your pain. Master your pain. But how can you master your pain if you're not aware of it? It's going to be hard to master your pain and master your child's pain, because you're really not aware of their pain. But that's what we have to do. We have to master our pain. We have to stop being afraid of our pain. Because we've all experienced it. I'm just going to do a quick summary review. Anytime we're in survival or reacting, we're in our amygdala or we're in our brainstem. When we're in survival or reacting, we're in the amygdala or the brainstem. We have to move up to responding, which is hypothalamic activation, which is where the oxytocin gets turned on, which then puts us up to the hippocampus, the processing, so we can start to think clearly. And then we move up into our right and integrating our prefrontal cortex. Our prefrontal cortex being our executive control center for social emotional relationships. That part of your brain doesn't complete its development until you're 25 years old. Your executive control center for your social emotional relationships does not come into a full maturity and online until you're 25. Yes, sir. Any question?
Yeah. What is can you give an example of what does responding look like? We can all know what survival and reacting is.
Responding is making eye contact. Responding is stopping screaming or lowering the voice. Responding is, instead of tipping over a chair, not tipping over a chair. Responding is just all of a sudden showing back up with you. Because as long as I'm in survival and reaction, I'm like this. But when I start responding, then I do this. I might not even want to look at you, but I'm not acting out anymore. See, now I'm winning. See, when you're an adult and you're regulated and you're present, you understand those little nuances, what they mean. When your kid goes from screaming bloody Mary, I had a situation once. I was working at a group home in Colorado that we had, and there's this little kid named Christian, a little fat kid. He was big fat kid for him. He was like 11, and so everyone was freaked out by him. He had wore one of those sling blade haircuts, like one of the buzz cuts, different sling blade. So everyone was a little freaked out by him. One day, he got upset about something. I don't even know what he got upset about. So he busted out a window. Then he busted out another window. And see, in our homes, our treatment homes, we don't do consequences. We don't do behavior modification. We don't do restraint. So he's tripping. And so I'm up there with him. I say, "You're mad. I can tell you're mad." And he stops busting out the windows. Thank God, because windows are expensive. He goes outside, goes around the house. I'm right behind him. Goes around the house, comes up the front stairs. I still see this. He's walking through the living room, knocking stuff off. Goes in. Now he's kind of halfway running from me, right? Because I'm on. I'm not trying to chase him, I'm just following him. I'm staying in a contained emotional containment. I'm trying to contain him emotionally, not with my hands, but with my presence. So I'm staying with him, I'm not getting too overwhelmed. Staying with him, so he takes off, he runs down the hall into his bedroom, I follow him into his bedroom, I close the door, because that's exactly where I wanted him anyway. Because if I get him in his room, I'm containing the space that he has to feel threatened. See, as long as he's in the living room and outside with all the other kids and all the other staff, then there's all this sensory bombardment. It's overwhelming him. So the fact that he went to his room was great. So I go in there with him. I close the door. I stay by the door. I pick up a pillow because he's still in an escalated, dysregulated state. He's probably going to throw something. See, I'm not dumb when my thinking is online. It's when my thinking is not online that I get dumb and stop thinking. But as long as I'm staying present and staying regulated, I'm thinking clearly. My short-term memory's on. So I pick up a pillow. He throws it from the other side of the room, picks something up and throws it. But he's the one who's dysregulated, so he throws it, and it goes wherever. And so this is where the magic happens. As I say, I can see how upset you are. And he comes back around, and he stands right in front of me. He says, "Let me out." I said, no, buddy, I can't let you out. He says, "I want out." I said, "No, buddy, I can't let you out." We have to be able to get out of our thinking brains into our emotional brains when it comes to really connecting with these children. Because these children are so emotional. And because they are so emotional, because of the things they've experienced, because their amygdalas can get dialed up so fast and so intense, it's like volume being turned up to a 10 on really loud heavy metal music. Now, when you were a kid, when you were a teenager, that shit was cool. But now it ain't so cool. So the first thing you start trying to do is like get it calm down because it's stressing you out. But you've got to be able to see through that volume. You've got to, through that volume, you've got to be able to stay connected to that kid. And I said, no, buddy, I can't let you out. It's not safe out there, buddy. You don't feel safe out there, buddy. I'm not going to let you out, buddy. I can't let you out, buddy. I'm so mad. I'm so mad you don't feel safe. And I just started going into my emotions. Just started going into my emotions. Went back to the other side of the room. And I just stayed with it. And I said, and it makes me so sad. I can see this. This is 10 years ago. I can see it clear as day. And I leaned up against the wall, against the door. And I just started booing. And I said, you've been through so much, and it just makes me mad that I can't make you feel safe, and that you don't feel safe, and it just hurts me, and it makes me so sad. And I just started ooh, and I just slid down the wall. And he picked up some hand sanitizer, because at some point in all that, I cut my knee, so I had a little blood. He picked up his hand sanitizer. And this is the kid who hadn't been successful in any other place. And he came over and started putting the hand sanitizer on my knee, cleaning the blood. And I said, it's okay, buddy. It's okay. And he sat down next to me. And I just stayed with it. I said, I just want you to feel safe. I don't want you to feel so scared anymore. Because he was 11, he was big, but he was really 3. He was like a fat little 3-year-old. He was just lovable. Just fat cheeks, but when he's stressed, he looked scary. He scared people. But he wasn't scary. He was just scared. He wasn't scary. He was just scared. And that one incident created a breakthrough with him. He was literally that 3, 4, 5-year-old from that point forward. He went from being 11 to being scary to being that little 3, 4, 5-year-old. Because in times of stress, it's always the emotional age that's showing up. It's not the chronological age. It's not the cognitive age. It's the emotional age. That's what you're parenting. You're parenting the emotional age of these children. Trauma creates emotional barriers. Trauma, stress, and trauma arrest emotion, makes children emotionally arrested. They get emotionally arrested, so developmentally they don't progress. And so a lot of the behaviors you see, like the parents see and the running from the 13-year-old, that's what 2-year-olds do. 2-year-olds run away unattended. 13-year-olds don't do that. So you gotta speak to the emotional age. You gotta address the emotional age. And I'm telling you, breakthroughs are never that far away. If you can get out of your thinking brain, get into your emotion, and connect. And connect, but that's the scariest thing because of what we've been through. It's the scariest thing because of the traumas that we've been through, because the stressors that we've been through. You know, I'm talking about getting to places within yourself that your parents probably never went to with you. They probably never went to those places with you. And so it's so hard because you don't have a paradigm for that. You don't have a paradigm for getting emotionally connected instead of mad and being in protection, survival and protection. But that's where the breakthrough is at. The breakthrough is in the emotional connection. So thinking about trauma, any stressful event which is prolonged, overwhelming, and unpredictable. When we don't have a chance to express, process, and understand, that's the difference between a short-term stressful event versus a long-term traumatic event. So you have to know your story, and I brought this up this morning. What was your birth? It starts there. What are these stories that define and create this paradigm for you? Without judgment. It's without judgment. It's not about judgment. It's not about making anyone bad or blaming anyone. It's about knowing what your stuff is so you can become more conscious of it. Because if you're not more conscious of it, it's going to keep having control over you. Because until you're more conscious of it, it has control. As long as it's unconscious, it has control. And I took a group of parents through a 30-day process called Inside the Parenting Matrix. Because I believe we all live inside of this matrix programming, this generational, decade-long conditioning for how we parent. It's just automated. It's like we grow up in it. And we're just mired in it. This matrix just dictates to us all the time. And we have to break out of the matrix. But you only break out of the matrix through starting to question what you haven't questioned before. What was going on with grandma and grandpa? Where was great-grandma and great-grandpa at? What was their experience? And how did that experience get passed down to us? And how did that get passed down to my mom and dad? What was my mom and dad's experience growing up? And how does that impact me? My mom and dad, I've got my biological experience, which is hardwired into my DNA, then I have my adoptive experience. My mom and dad were both children of alcoholics. Both of their fathers died young. My dad's dad was killed in a bar. My mom's dad had a heart attack right in front of her when she was 9 years old. Those are life-altering traumatic experiences. Then my dad was a Vietnam veteran, had severe PTSD. This was a man who raised us. He did the best he can, with what he had to work with, but he operated from inside the matrix because that's just the conditioning. If we don't question, if we don't work through, if we don't challenge our own pain, that's just what we do. We go on autopilot. And the matrix is very much about autopilot parenting. Just doing what everyone else does because that's just what you do. That's the worst excuse in the book. It's the worst excuse in the book. That just keeps us trapped. It keeps us from being able to break free and break down and having deeper relationships with one another. So you got to ask yourself, what were those stories? What are your own stories without judgment? Just with a seeking for a deeper consciousness, a deeper awareness, a deeper mindfulness. Because when your child is acting out, anytime you are reacting to any person or anything, it has far less to do with that person or that thing and far more to do with you. Any behavior that is showing up in your life right now with your children that is stressing you out has a deeper anchor in some kind of story in your life. And that's the gift these children give you. The gift these children are giving you is an opportunity to work on shit that you ain't worked on before. That's the gift. Because you wouldn't work on it if they weren't in your home stressing you the hell out. Because no one wants to work on that crap. We don't want to look at that. How many of us just voluntarily go into therapy? No. But we'll sure take those little kiddos and kick them in that office, won't we? Call me when you're done. No. I don't do therapy that way. When I work with families, I always start with the parents. Always. If I get called because the kid has got some severe behavior, I don't work with that kid. I don't want to work with your kid. I don't even like kids that much. I want to work with the family. I want to start with you because I see you as the most significant regulatory figure in that child's life. You are the pathway to healing that child's brain, not me. I'm going to spend the majority of my time with you, and then I'm going to spend the majority of my time with you and your child. I'm not going to work with your child by themselves, unless they're a teenager. I might spend an hour or so working with a teenager just to help them have some more consciousness of what their struggle is, but I ain't working with that kid by themselves because you're the healing influence in their life. If I can't help you get to that deeper place of understanding, if I can't help you see through that different lens, then nothing's going to make any difference. It's just not. There's not enough influence, there's not enough impact to hold up. Any therapy or technique that's confrontational, aggressive, threatening, blaming, or fear-based will ultimately not be effective in creating healing environments for attachment challenged children. This is an important concept. Some of you have heard of reactive attachment disorder. Children who've been adversely affected early in life, usually 0 to 3, from some kind of abuse or some kind of trauma, don't form attachments with adults as readily. So they label that as reactive attachment disorder. I don't call it attachment disorder, I call it attachment challenges. Because when we're stressed, we're all attachment challenged. You can be with your partner or your spouse right now, And you could have just made love over lunch, over the lunch break, and they might say something to you that you don't like, and you get triggered, and all of a sudden they're the worst person in the world. That quick. You just went from a beautiful and relaxing experience to, oh my God, I can't believe we're still married. Why did I marry you? That quick. So when we're stressed and we move into survival, any of us can have attachment challenges. Now here's the thing. Attachment is the behavior of the child towards the parent. Bonding is the behavior of the parent to the child. The only way a child can develop secure attachment is they have to experience prolonged states of regulation of relationship. And when there is stress, it has to be repaired. It has to be repaired. How many of you grew up in homes where your parents messed up and apologized? Anyone? A few. 10 out of 100? It's just not like, it's just not the norm. It's not the condition. But that's one of the easiest things we can do is when we screw up, realize that we screw up, eat that humble pie and go apologize to your child and say, I want to do something different. I'm sorry I keep behaving this way. It's so hard to do something different. We're so on top of our children and their behaviors, but we don't check our own behaviors. What if I was smacking you on the back of the head every morning when you didn't stop and give your child 60, 90 minutes of a hug and tell them how much you love them and make an eye contact with them? Or when you're sitting at the table and you got your phone out just like they got their phone out. All of a sudden, you get smacked. We don't check ourselves as parents. But if you want to have these breakthroughs, if you want to create this healing for these kids, you have to. Because their brains are relying on your brain. Their brains are relying on your regulation. They're relying on what you can do for them by providing that safety and that regulation and that oxytocin and that consistency and that security. And not getting so overwhelmed. And when you do get overwhelmed, recovering. You can't expect them to recover first. Your child shouldn't come back and apologize to you before you go and apologize to them. But they will. But you've got to be able to get them to the place where you can apologize. And the best way to do that is by messing up. I love to advocate for messing up as a parent. In fact, the sooner you can go mess up after this talk, the better. Just go screw up. Because I want you to stop and I want you to look after you screwed up. I want you to say, where was the stress? How was I feeling before that happened? What was going on with him or her? And what could I have done differently? Remember, it's real simple. Remember the three things that you do to increase stress, the three things that you do to decrease stress, and do less of the things that increase and more of the things that decrease. At a very basic level. At the most basic level. I don't deal in diagnosis with children. I haven't dealt with diagnosis with children for 20 years. Because if a child in a home has a diagnosis, guess what? There's enough stress in that home for everyone to have a diagnosis. If you've got a child with diagnosis, with multiple diagnoses, you've got a child with medication, I guarantee you there's enough stress going on in your home right now that every single one of you can have a diagnosis. So when I give your child a diagnosis, and I know that, the problem is most professionals don't realize that. But I realize it, I know it. If I do that, then I'm scapegoating your child. And most children don't even need a diagnosis to be scapegoated. They're already foster kid, or they're already adopted, or they're already a kinship placement, so we already view them in a certain way, like they're just a little bit inadequate, and like there's something not quite right, and just, you know, they haven't had experience. So then you tack on a few diagnoses, and then he needs his Ritalin, give him his Adderall. Now you really do have a negatively skewed perception of this kid. The difference between me and my sister, like I said, my mom took a look at my biological mom. Thank the Lord, she ate good. She didn't smoke, didn't drink with me. She enjoyed being pregnant up until 7 months. 7 months pregnant, she knew she couldn't keep me. So I got the beauty of 7 months. 7 months of good brain development, healthy, good brain development. She ate lots of salmon. I still love salmon. My sister, my adopted sister, She was perhaps exposed in utero. She was born premature, 3 months premature. She had to spend her first 3 months of life in an incubator. And yet we were adopted to the same home. But our experiences were night and day different. Night and day different. Even though I had all kinds of behavior problems. The whole list of behavior issues. I got along well socially. I got along well emotionally. I got along well in school. So I had friends. The teachers liked me. My sister, she didn't have any friends. Teachers didn't like her very much. My own parents didn't like her very much because they didn't understand. Extended family, there's Christy. So where my experience, everyone around me was positive. Everyone looking at me was sending me a positive vibration. My sister's experience was just different. It was just fundamentally different. Everyone around her was looking at her with negativity. She was getting a negative vibration everywhere she went. And she didn't even have a diagnosis. She may have been better off with one. And her behaviors weren't as bad as mine. But it's just how it matched up for her. Let's talk about stress model. Any questions about the brain model? A generous understanding of the brain. That's all you need. Just have to be able to see that these children, the amygdalas are stress sensitive, and they get easily overwhelmed and they don't have enough oxytocin going on. Let's talk about the stress model. This is something I discovered 20 years ago. And this is what I was saying to you earlier today. When I said, it is believed that affect dysregulation is a fundamental mechanism involved in all psychiatric disorders. It is believed that being stressed out is the fundamental cause of all psychological, emotional, and behavioral challenges. That was the beginning of my enlightenment. Because I understood then that that is true. That is true. That is true. And so then I came up with the stress model. The stress model says all behavior arises from a state of stress. All behavior arises from a state of stress. Remember, we can experience stress through any of our sensory pathways, and it's going to almost always be unconscious. You're not going to know when you're feeling stress. You know, you might feel tired right now, but you may have already made it through that because you've already had another session. When you start feeling tired and knock off, that's called hypoarousal. We all react to stress in one of two different ways. We become hypo-aroused or hyper-aroused. Boys are two-thirds more likely than girls to be hyper-aroused, and girls are two-thirds more likely than boys to be hypo-aroused. Hyper-aroused was towards the aggressive side. Hypo-aroused is towards the depressed side. So when you start nodding off, it's because your body's under a state of stress. Under that state of stress, what it's doing is it's suppressing your system. So you get tired. It's a natural experience. Stress is a natural thing. But you can have a stress experience through any of your sensory pathways. What you see, what you hear, what you taste, what you touch, what you smell. Temperature, movement, and digestion. You will experience that stress and it will weigh on your window of tolerance. All behavior arises from a state of stress. In between the behavior and the stress is the presence of a primary emotion. There are only two primary emotions, love and fear. It is through the expression, the processing, and the understanding of the fear that we calm the stress and diminish the behavior. It's through the expression, the processing, and the understanding of the fear that we calm the stress and we diminish the behavior. You have to start seeing fear. When that client of mine 20 years ago, her name was Nancy Clark. Nancy Clark 20 years ago said, "Brian, what are you afraid of?" And when I connected to my fear, it changed my life. It changed my life. because it gave me awareness. It gave me consciousness, and then I could have control. Without that awareness, without that consciousness, I was hostage. I was hostage to the anxiety. I was hostage to the overwhelm. So the stress model says all behavior arises from a state of stress. In between the behavior and the stress is the presence of a primary emotion. There are only two primary emotions, love and fear. It's through the expression, the processing, and the understanding of fear that we calm the stress and we diminish the behavior. The thing you have to realize is that stress and fear is an interchangeable experience. Remember, your body only knows surviving and thriving. So once your body moves into survival, you're already in an emotion of fear. It's a survival emotion. It's the biggest challenge. It's the only challenge to operate not in a state of fear, but in a state of love. That's the biggest challenge. And love always exists. Love always is around us. Love surrounds us. It's the space in between us. In any given moment, all we have to do is take a deep breath and get out of fear and move into love. It's always waiting for us. It's always waiting for us. Love never goes away. And the only thing that keeps us from love and being in relationships secured by love is fear. It's the only thing. Not diagnosis, not medication. Fear. And it could be years of conditioned fear. It could be generations of conditioned fear. But that's the only thing keeping us from experiencing love in any given moment is fear. So here's where the stress model gets dynamic in nature. Is because all behavior arises from a state of stress. So as soon as you see the behavior, you become stressed. And as soon as you become stressed, it triggers your fear. And then the fear drives your behavior. Now you got two people who are stressed out and afraid. So what we have to be able to do is when we see behavior, we've got to be able to slow down. Slow down. We've got to be able to breathe. We've got to be able to take a step back. We've got to be able to say, I'm not at risk. I'm not going to die. Because that's what happens. You think you're going to die. In that moment, you think you're going to die. That's why you get so anxious. That's why you get so worked up. Because there's something in you that's saying, I'm going to die if he doesn't stop lying to me. I'm going to die if he don't turn that television off. Have you ever just lost your mind over your kid not turning the TV off? I mean, just lost your shit. Like, Mom! Do you ever think you're crazy? You know the question? What is going on? It happens. That stress. We have to be able to calm ourselves down. Slow down. See, slowing down doesn't mean you get less fat. It means you slow down your brain. You slow down your amygdala. Your amygdala is like a red bouncy ball. The more stress you get, the higher it bounces, the faster it bounces. It's like a hamster on a hamster wheel. The more stress you get, the faster it goes. And it's just sending out thoughts. You got to slow it down. And the best way to slow it down is to breathe. Master the ability to remain calm. Master your pain. And when you're able to do that, you're able to realize, see, that this is a fantastic model. It's a fantastic model. It makes everything very simple for you. If your child is acting out, it doesn't matter what the behavior is, it's because they're stressed out. The biggest challenge is for you not to get stressed out. If you can keep from getting stressed out, you will help reduce their fear and reduce their stress, which reduces their behavior. You do that over and over and over again, and the behavior goes away. So I just completely stopped. It was the most fantastic thing when I discovered this. Parents would come up to me at lectures, and they would say, well, what about my kid who's doing this? And I said, well, tell me about it. And they start telling me about it. They tell me all these stressors and these traumas in this child's life. And I'm seeing stress. I'm telling them, well, tell me how it happens. Like, what's going on? You're in the buildup. You know, give me an example. I had a lady in the audience once. She said, my son gets real angry. He gets aggressive. I said, well, come up here. And she came up to the front of the room. I said, I'm going to be you. I want you to be your son. And I said, so I'm over here. I'm minding my own business. Tell me what he does. I said, okay. He does. That's the first thing he does. Okay, cool. Let's start over. She goes, ah. And I walk over. I said, come here, honey. It's okay. I picked her up. It's okay. She's a little woman. It's okay, baby. I got you. I got you. I soothed the baby. I soothed the 2-year-old. Not the 13-year-old. I soothed the 2-year-old. But what she would do when he would go, huh, is get stressed. Try to ignore it. Try to be calm. See, when we say we're being calm, we're being calm. Not in here. Walking on eggshells is not calm. So he go, huh, and she tried to ignore it. Well, she's ignoring it. She's moving away from him emotionally. Don't tell him what that's triggering. Which then just starts driving more and more and more. Aggressive children is a paradox, because aggressive children are aggressive because they're afraid of being abandoned. It's a paradox. They're aggressive because they're afraid of being abandoned. They attack because they're afraid of you leaving. And it just becomes a negative reinforcing cycle, because they attack him. What do you want to do? Get the hell away. I get it. I get the hell away too. But you got to be able to get away in a way that keeps yourself safe and also says to them, I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not going to hurt you. I had a kid pull a knife on me once in a house. I was doing some work. I was working with his mom. She's getting real emotional. He went in the kitchen, pulled a steak out. I came back in. He was standing there. He says, I'm going to kill someone. The therapist I was with, Sonya Brady, looked at me. She was sitting on the ground. She was closest to him. And she looked at me and she went, didn't look at him. He said, I'm going to kill someone. I said, Joe, I'm not going to hurt you, buddy. I said, Joe, I'm not going to hurt you. Joe was the one holding the freaking knife. Why did I say that? Because the only reason Joe wouldn't have the knife is because he was afraid something was going to happen. I said, Joe, I'm not going to hurt you. And I'm not going to hurt your mama. You're safe. He said, well, I'm going to kill myself then. And puts the knife to his throat. And I said, that made me really sad, buddy. And we had not moved a stitch. No voices that elevated. I had not moved. And he went and he put the knife away. And then we continued doing what we were doing. Now tell me the 20 different ways that could have went bad. Because immediately fear says this kid's got to kill somebody. And as soon as we see that in our brains, we see the worst. Oh yeah, better story than that. We were at a group home. Christy and I, and some of you, if you interact with the Post Institute, Christy is the mother of my 15-year-old Marley. We were married for a while. We're not married any longer, but we still work together. She still helps me run the Post Institute. We run it together. But when you interact with the Post Institute, usually you're going to interact with Kristen. She's the sweetest, most loving person you're probably ever going to meet in your life. Very skilled, very talented. She's a fantastic mother. God has blessed me with amazing mothers. I have two biological daughters. One 23, she's a social worker in Oklahoma now. And then my 15-year-old, very gifted, talented 15-year-old. And both of them have amazing mothers. It's a real blessing for me. I've also had a 26-year-old adopted son. So Chris and I, when Marlon was 2, we were in Colorado at one of our group homes. And I was outside with the staff. The kids were riding their bikes. We were sitting out there, it was real pretty. And it's early morning, and all of a sudden I hear Christy let out this blood-curdling scream. Oh my God! Oh my God! You know that scream. That scream that's beyond just scared or mad, that terror scream. So I jumped up. Immediately in my head, I thought one of the kids had got hit by a car, because they would have been riding their bike. So I ran to the front of the house, and I heard her scream again. I realized she was inside the house, so I ran in, ran downstairs. And she was like, she can't breathe, she can't breathe. And Marley was sitting on the floor, and she was and she had this bottle bubble top. The top from a bottle, she had swallowed it. And it was lodged in her throat. And so I picked her up, Heimlich, shaking, hit him, turning upside down, you know, I'm sticking my finger in her mouth, and her teeth, you know, so she had the little two-year-old teeth, and so it was just gnawing up my hand, and I got my finger in there, and I could just feel that top, and I could push it, and she'd go, and she'd get a little air, but I couldn't get behind it. And so I am like, you know, this is all occurring within minutes. Feels like forever, within seconds. So I pull my finger out again. Oh, you know, because she's getting really purple. And so, yeah, I stick my finger back in there again, and all of a sudden, my freaking arms. I got pretty good sized arms. My arms went limp. They went limp, and I looked at Christy, and I said, I can't do it. I started seeing Marlon dead on the floor in front of me. And I started seeing the ambulance in my head. I started seeing the ambulance. And I started thinking, oh my God, my two-year-old daughter is going to die in my arms. Oh my God. And I went limp. And she's still gagging on this top. And I said to Christy, I can't do it. And as soon as I said that, it's like another one of those times when God hit me on the head. He went, breathe. I took a deep breath. Reached my finger and pulled it out. And then adrenaline just, oh God. So when I tell you, master your calm, master your pain, I'm dead serious. When I tell you that that child's behavior, the midst of that child's behavior, the best thing you can do for that child to do for yourself, is calm yourself down. That's coming from a framework where I saw my child dying in front of me. And so literally, my window of tolerance for behaviors gets so wide, because none of it's that serious. The things that we think are serious are just not that serious. When your child's screaming and cussing, oh my God, okay. Well, tell me more. I mean, that's like my reaction. I'm getting cussed out by a kid, and I'm like, thank you. Man, you're mad. Tell me more about that. My goodness. Now, what do? They stop cussing. And then in the day-to-day, when we're just driving along, this is back when we're in the group home, we're just driving along, they'll be cussing. All I have to do is look back or put my little review. Say, hey, D, choose some better words. That's all. I gotta get into a whole bunch of drama. I'm not gonna take your points away. You're not gonna get isolated. You're not gonna lose ice cream. Just stop. Just choose a better word. That's all. When you have a relationship, you have that kind of power. But if you spend all your time obsessed on your kids' behaviors because you're stressed out and scared, you're losing relationship. You're losing relationship. The older you get, the older your children get, the more time you invest in trying to control their behaviors, and you can do it till they're probably 10. But after 10, you're going to lose. You're going to lose, and you're going to come crying to me when your kid's 14 and out of control and you don't know what else to do. And I said, well, when he was 10, I told you to invest in a relationship, didn't I? See, we get too scared. All you have to do is calm your fear. Just dial it down in degrees. Maintain the relationship. Because you maintain the relationship, you have the ability to influence your child lifelong. Lifelong. What kind of time are we looking at? Got auditions to do for a TV show up in my room after I get finished talking right at 4 o'clock. This is the parenting continuum. On the right hand side, you see reactivity and fear. On the left hand side, you see responsibility and law. And you see this continuum. 0, negative 1 to 10, all the way up to 100. Positive 1 to 10, all the way to positive 100. On the far extreme of the reactivity and fear side, you see the death penalty. On the far extreme of the love and responsibility side, you see perfect love. My contention is this. The most common things we do with children fall on the continuum, the reactivity and fear side of the continuum from -1 to -10. The most common things we do when we deal with children's behaviors is -1 to -10. The common denominators, they are all based in reactivity and fear. They're all based in reactivity and fear. The far extreme of that side of the continuum is the death penalty. And is the death penalty an effective deterrent to crime? No. The reason the death penalty is not an effective deterrent to crime is because when people do bad things, it's because they are stressed out, and the last thing on their mind is the death penalty. When your children are acting out, the last thing on their mind is you giving them a timeout. When a child is in a stress and overwhelmed and in a post-traumatic stress reaction, the last thing they are thinking about and the last thing they care about is your consequence. And that's why you have to keep giving it to them over and over and over again. A child who's acting out isn't thinking about you spanking them. It doesn't even register in their brain. You think they're thinking about you, but they are not. They are reenacting their trauma and the emotions that are associated with that trauma. Now here's the even more challenging part of this, is that these are the most common things we do. The timeout, the isolation, the spanking, the consequences, behavior modification. Why do we do them? We do them because they work. These things work for 70% of children. These things work for the children that you raised, your biological children that are already grown. These things worked. But here's the key to that. For that 70% of children, anything you do will work. Because their brains can tolerate stress. For your biological children that you raised and they didn't have significant trauma, they didn't really need you. They didn't really need you. Like you patted yourself on the back and you did it. No. They had a brain that was not traumatized. You could have raised your eyebrow, and you did, and you raised your voice. You may have swatted Johnny when he was 5. But that's it. Johnny was going to get there anyway. Because his brain is not a trauma brain. The 30% of kids you're raising right now, they have trauma brains. And these things only make it worse. Their brains cannot handle this kind of parenting. And not only that, I'm going to put something heavy on you. I don't do it to shame you. I just do it for you to think. When you give a traumatized child a consequence for their behavior, remember, the trauma came first in this child's life. The trauma came before you came. When you give a traumatized child a consequence for their behavior, you are essentially consequencing them for their trauma. You are saying your trauma is your fault. That is what you are unconsciously communicating to that child. So it gets real heavy when you get into the real punitive stuff. But you know what? None of that's your fault because you get taught this stuff from professionals. Professionals teach you this stuff. You know why? Because they're stressed out and scared and haven't dealt with their own shit. Don't do time out, do time in. Children don't act out for attention, they act out because they need attention. They don't need to be sent over to the corner by themselves, they need to be brought in with you. Do time in, regulate them. They are acting out because they are stressed out because they've gone outside of their window of tolerance. They need your connection. They need your regulatory influence. Isolation, don't put kids in their room by themselves. If you need to be in isolation or if you need a timeout, take it for yourself. Just say, I'm gonna go have me a timeout in my bedroom with this martini. Take me about 10 minutes. 20. Y'all leave me alone. Take the time out, take your isolation, and enjoy it. And take it for you. Take it for you because your children need your regulatory presence. That's how their brain is going to heal. Spanking, don't spank. Don't hit kids. It's unnecessary. We're so much smarter than that now. We're so much more advanced than that now. That's such a barbaric practice for so many of us to still believe that it's okay to hit kids. And the Bible says, spare the rod, spoil the child. The rod and the staff were used in the raising of sheep by the shepherd. The rod was used to keep them in line. The staff was used to pull them back in the line when they strayed. The rod wasn't used by the shepherd to beat the sheep over the head with. Spare the rod, spoil the child means spare the child guidance, and they would be spoiled to the ways of the world. If the sheep are afraid of the shepherd, they run away, and what happens to them? They get eaten by the wolves and the coyotes. So the sheep have to love the shepherd. They can't be afraid of the shepherd. The shepherd has to love them, not beat them, but guide them, pull them back into line, stay in relationship with them. Consequences. That's a big one. We're all the time talking about that. Probably the biggest one is the one where you're told about natural consequences. You know, a natural consequence is natural. You can't create it. You can't create a natural consequence. It's natural. Anything else is a formulated consequence. And yes, we all work for consequences, but not formulated consequences. When you're consequencing that child for their behavior, you're not taking responsibility for your role in teaching them how to do anything different. You're expecting them to figure it out, and you're punishing them by doing it. A consequence is a punishment. A punishment is going to create more stress. Now, you might have a child, you might go to the store, and let me just give you two different ways of looking at it. One takes responsibility, the other one's reactive. Let's talk about the reactive way first. You take this kid to the grocery store, you get in the grocery store, you look at him, you say, get in the basket, you little thief. You steal, you're going to get in the basket, that's the consequence of your behavior. Right in the basket. That feels so good, doesn't it? Or you could take more of a responsible approach. You could pull up to the grocery store, and I've done this with six adolescent boys. You can say, hey, we're going to go to the grocery store, it's kind of stressful, we're going to get what we need, you're going to stay with me, we'll go in, we're going to get out. You get to the grocery store, you say, you know what? I know it's stressful being in the grocery store. Why don't you get in the basket? Because in the basket, I can keep you safe. And you don't take things that don't belong to you. You don't get stressed. I don't get stressed. We'll be okay. Now, I know you're 14 years old. Right? What's said? Just heard him. But really, if you got a kid who's 14 years old who wants to get in the basket, let him get in the basket because emotionally not 14. But keep them with you. Keep them with you. I went through, literally walked through Walmart pushing a basket with six adolescent boys who, you know, these boys ranged from 13 to 18. The 18-year-old was like 6'4". And they were following me like some little ducklings. Hey, Pops, can we have this? Nope. Hey, Pops, can we have this? What do you think about this? Oh, Pops, this will be real good. Nope. Keep going. Ching. Hey, Pops, this would be real good. It sure would be. Hey, Pops, what about this? Nope. Hey, Pops. Nope. Check it out. Go home. No incidents. All six. That's containment. But what do? We get to Walmart. We let them take off running. They steal. Stressed out. We're spending now 3-4 hours. Containment. Reducing the space that they have to feel threatened and taking responsibility. See, when we take responsibility, we don't have to punish because we're teaching. Here's the definition between reactivity and responsibility. Reactivity is automatic, it's unconscious, requires no effort, and maximum energy. Now think about that. When you're being reactive, it's unconscious and it requires maximum energy. When you have a really stressful situation with your kid and it's all done, you're exhausted. Because you've been in survival. You've been in survival. It's fear-based, it punishes and it controls. Responsibility on the other side is delayed. Slow down. Nothing bad is going to happen in this moment. In fact, the likelihood that something bad is going to happen in this moment increases by you not slowing down. The likelihood that something bad happens increases when you don't slow down. You got a kid who's taking off and they're running to traffic. They're running to traffic. The first thing you want to do is run after them. The worst thing you can do is run after them. Because when they see you running after them, they're going to run faster. The best thing you can do is slow down and stop. Call their name, smile, and turn your back. Scariest thing in the world. But that stops them in their tracks because you're not sending that vibration. Same way with a kid who's threatening to harm themselves. I'm going to kill myself. The best thing you can do is slow down. Take a deep breath. That makes me really sad. Connect emotionally. That makes me really sad. What's going on? I'm not going to talk you out of it. I'm not going to call 911. I'm going to listen. I'm going to connect. The kid's getting agitated. He's getting angry. He's getting frustrated. He's yelling. The worst thing you can do is yell more. Calm down. Slow it down. Slow your brain down. The responsibility side requires effort and energy. It does require energy, but it's preventative energy. It's not reactive energy. It's love-based. It teaches and it influences. Creating a therapeutic environment. The first is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the ability to pay attention to yourself, pay attention to what you're thinking and what you're feeling. This is a huge practice. If you can start practicing mindfulness, how long will it take?
3:42.
If you can start practicing mindfulness, slowing down and paying attention to what you're thinking and feeling, everything starts to shift. Everything starts to shift because you start moving into a preventative brain. If you have challenging children, one of the reasons you have recurring issues right now is because you're in a reactive brain. And a reactive brain is always anticipating something to happen. It's always anticipating something's going to happen. A preventive brain thinks ahead of it happening. Things ahead of that. And so it makes the actions, it takes the efforts to prevent it from ever occurring. You practice prevention instead of reaction. Mindfulness is what allows you to do that. Understanding the dynamic of fear. Being emotionally flexible and matching your children's emotions instead of always trying to suppress them, match them sometimes. Be as angry as they are, but don't be angry at them, be angry for them. And learn to be emotionally flexible. As long as you're stressed out, you can't be emotionally flexible. Awareness, affection, and attunement, the three A's. When we are stressed out, those are the first things that go. We stop being aware, we stop being affectionate, and we stop being attuned. And those are three really important things. I'm going to tell you the most stressed out child in your home is the one who has, you pay the least awareness, they get the least affection, and they get the least attunement. Because you're in a negative feedback loop. You create stress with one another. It goes back to that relationship thing. They need the awareness, the affection, and the attunement more than anybody else. They're the ones requiring your hard work. Do time in instead of time out. Learning how to create emotional and environmental containment. Emotional containment is not getting overwhelmed when your child is upset. Being able to calm yourself down and stay emotionally present. Emotional environmental containment is reducing the space that your child has to roll around in. If I had a 10-year-old in here, I'm not going to sit at the front desk and the front table like the 10-year-old be over there. I'm going to have the 10-year-old here over here by me. So I've got to do the things that I need to do in order to contain the environmental space because it keeps the stress levels down. 10-20-10. It's a very powerful tool. It says, for the worst child in the home, all you have to do is give this child, and if you'll do this for 2 weeks consistently, I'll guarantee you a 50% reduction in their behaviors. In their worst behaviors, 50% reduction. 10-20-10. 10 minutes of quality time and attention first thing in the morning, 20 minutes of time and attention first thing in the afternoon when they get home from school or you get home from work, and 10 minutes in the evening before bed. Quality time and attention, 10-20-10. If you do that for 2 weeks straight, you'll have a 50% reduction in the worst behavior. The The three-phase intervention, it's another one. The three-phase intervention says as long as the child is not at risk of harming themselves or someone else, you gotta be able to make that distinction. Just like the kid who was holding up the knife, he's not harming anyone. Even when he's holding the knife to himself, he's not harming himself. He's posturing. You gotta know the difference, but only a regulated brain can know the difference. So you gotta be able to slow your brain down enough to be able to know the difference. But as long as the child is not at risk, it's not at risk of harming themselves or someone else, the first thing you gotta do when a child is acting out is you stop and take 3 to 10 deep breaths and you ask yourself how you feel. And that's called reflecting. So the three-phase intervention is to reflect, relate, and regulate. You stop, take 3 to 10 deep breaths, and you reflect. You ask how you're feeling. Then you relate by saying to your child, I'm feeling scared, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling sad, how are you feeling? That's relating. They're probably not gonna know because they're stressed out. So they're gonna say, I don't know, but by the time they say, I don't know, see, you've already moved up to responding. See, that's that modeling. The reflecting in the presence of that stress is when they're in survival. So when you reflect and slow down, you're already moving them towards responding. So then you say, well, I'm feeling scared and stressed. You look like you're probably feeling the same way. You move into regulate. I had a parent, same parent I mentioned earlier, Nancy Clark. First time I ever met Nancy, I didn't meet her. She sent me an email. She said, my child talks nonstop, incessantly, mindless chatter about nothing at all. What can I do about that? I emailed her back. I said, do you ever listen? She said, no. 10-20-10. Fix that. She emailed me again. She had called me this time. She said, every single night is a bad time to have. Every single night is a bad time to have. As soon as I mentioned back to my nine-year-old adopted daughter, Nancy was 67 at the time. She was 63 at the time. 9 year old doctor. Every time I mention bath time, my daughter puts out on the ground. She starts kicking and screaming. She's not going to take a bath. I just jump on her. I just hold her down until she calms down. And then as soon as we walk into the bathroom, she sees the tub and immediately starts looking at me. But this time she's going to take a bath whether she likes it or not. Even if I got to get in that tub with all my clothes on. So we get in that tub, splishing water, splashing everywhere. She takes that bath, I don't even bother washing her hair. It was so bad at washing her hair, she just took it to the hairdresser to get it done. And then we both fall out on the floor exhausted. And then you know what? She won't even go to bed. Then she won't go to sleep. What do I do about that? I said, well, here's what I want you to do. The next time she flips out, the next time it's bad time, she flips out, instead of jumping on her, hold her down. I want you to sit on the bed and take 3 to 10 deep breaths and ask yourself how you feel. Sit on the bed, take 3 to 10 deep breaths and ask yourself how you feel. She emailed me back. She said, that doesn't seem like very sound therapeutic advice. She's been a marriage and family therapist for 30 years. I said, well, just give it a shot. So it was a few nights later, she called. That's all I wanted her to do. All I wanted her to do was sit on the bed, take some deep breaths, and get in touch with how she's feeling in that moment. And then call me back. Let me know. That's step one. So you've been dealing with these behaviors for so long, you don't have to get in a rush when it comes to fix it up. There's no rush. The behavior's going to be back tomorrow. Slow down. Let's just take it easy. And we can dissect it. Because all severe behavior is predictable. Let's say that again. All severe behavior is predictable. All severe behavior is predictable. Your kids don't catch you by surprise. You knew it was going to come. You were trying to ignore it and hope that it wouldn't come. So they're not catching you by surprise. So she called me back. She called me. And she said, you're never going to believe what happened. I mentioned that time. And she started flipping out all around like she always does. But this time, sat on the bed. She said, do you realize she completely stopped what she was doing, climbed up on my lap as if she needed a hug, realized she didn't, and then she went and got in the bathtub? That's too much for my own heart. And that was the beginning of the end of their bathtub problems. When I went out and worked with her, eventually found out that this little girl was picked up by social services. She had lice so thick on her, you could pick it off with your fingers. So the bath, taking her bath and getting her hair washed was PTSD for her. So it immediately sent her back into her stuff. And Mom, Nancy, when she was a little girl, her older sister used to yell at her in her face all the time. So the little girl yelling and throwing a tantrum was triggering her. So you have two people struggling with PTSD in that moment. So by getting Nancy, the parent, to just back up, calm down, actually gave her daughter space. So I had another mom, heard me tell the same story. She had a nine-year-old daughter. Funny enough, nine-year-old daughter's name was Christina. She heard me tell the story. She said, "My daughter, we've always had problems with her taking a shower." So I thought I'd try, and she emailed me. It's 2 weeks after the talk. It's funny how you can still remember certain things. Like, I can remember sitting there looking at that paragraph of that email. Her name was Lanelia, and she said, "My daughter Christina always had problems taking a shower. So I heard you tell that story, and I thought, hey, I'll try that." So she said, I went home, and I was breathing. I calmed myself down. I went upstairs and said, "Honey, it's time to take a shower." Sure enough, she started talking back, rolling her eyes, huffing and puffing. Well, she always does. But this time, I was calm. And I said, "Honey, if you need anything, I'll be right there." She said she went and got in the shower. I was surprised. But sure enough, she calls me just like she always does. "Mom, the water's too hot, too cold. I dropped the towel on the floor. I don't like the soap." She said, "Usually it loves to hang out." But this time, I was breathing, I was calm, I went and I got it, whatever she needed. And I said, "Honey, if you need anything else, I'll be right here." And she said, "I just sat there in the bathroom." She said, "That was the best shower we have had in 5 years." So I thought I'd go for a home run. So my nine-year-old daughter still had her towel wrapped around her. I went to her bedroom, she sat on the bed, I sat on the edge of the bed, I put my arm around her, I said, "Honey, that was the best shower we've had in 5 years. What scares you so much about taking a shower?" She said, "My nine-year-old daughter looked at me and said, 'Well, Mom, the guy who sexually molested me made me take a shower with him.'" Mom knew about the sexual molestation. She didn't know about the shower. Because she was calm and she was regulated, she said, "Honey, you don't have to take a shower anymore. You can take a bath." She said, "My daughter's taking a bath so fast now, I hardly even know she's in and out." That's 5 minutes to overcome 5 years. 5 years. In 5 minutes, just by looking at fear, just by asking, "What is this child so afraid of in this moment?" And I've been doing this for 20 years. 20 years, and I am preaching to you the same message, the same message, with a little bit more passion and a little bit more wisdom, but it hadn't changed in 20 years. And if it hadn't changed in 20 years, I'm telling you, someone in here is going to have a breakthrough in their home with their child, because they're going to see stress and fear first, and they're going to ignore the behavior, but not ignore the child. You're going to have a breakthrough. And I'll see you next time when I'm in Michigan. Come tell me about. God bless you. Have a good evening.